The entire text of the Second Amendment in the Bill of Rights is just one sentence. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. But the meaning of those 27 words is one of the most contested issues in American public, political, and legal debate. Michael Waldman, president of the Brennan Center at NYU, examines its history in his new book called The Second Amendment, A Biography. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and I'm very pleased that it brings Michael Waldman to our show today. Hello.
Great to be with you.
Why a biography of the Second Amendment?
Well, because it turns out that the way we look at the Second Amendment, what it's meant, has changed over time. It turns out that far from the pristine constitutional text, how we regard those 27 words has been the subject of kind of the push and pull of public argument and political agitation from the beginning.
As a legal scholar, then, do you dispute originalist approaches to the Constitution?
As a general matter, I do. I don't think that the only way, as Justice Antonin Scalia would have it, I don't think the only way to interpret the Constitution is to ask what it meant or what the text meant at the moment of its drafting. But even so, there's been a misunderstanding and often a surprises in what they actually meant way back then. And this has proven to be especially important when it comes to guns.
Because it was a debate over the Second Amendment? Was there a debate over including it in the Bill of Rights?
There was, but there was certainly that. The Supreme Court of the United States never ruled that the Second Amendment recognized an individual right to gun ownership until 2008. That was the first time the Supreme Court had ever ruled that way, and it actually had ruled otherwise previously. And when they ruled, Justice Scalia said he was just following the original meaning. But the actual history of it and the debates were a bit different.
But haven't people who endorse originalism modified their views to deal with, most glaringly, the constitutional preservation of slavery?
Well, originalism is not, I don't think, ultimately a tenable way to understand the Constitution. So much has changed since the founding era that the way most of the time we've understood the way you ought to read the Constitution is, yes, to look at the original text, but also, and the original intent, but also to ask how has the country changed since then. What's interesting about the Second Amendment is when you actually look at what they were debating back then, that first half about the well-regulated militia, we actually kind of skip over that. We don't really understand what it means. That was of vast and passionate importance to the framers. The militias were not like anything we have now. They're not really like the National Guard. Every adult white man was required to be in the militia their entire adult life, and they were required by law to own a gun and keep it at home. And they thought that was a bulwark against tyranny. They thought that, among other things, would stand up against a standing army, what King George had. And they were worried that the new Constitution, when they proposed it and it thrust toward a stronger central government, would crush these state militias.
So were they suggesting that if you didn't like what the federal government was doing, the militias could then march on Washington or, I guess, initially on Philadelphia or New York?
Back then, if you read the Federalist Papers, James Madison actually says, don't worry about the fact that there could be a standing army, because the Constitution, Madison and Washington and Hamilton, they wanted a stronger central government. A lot of the people who opposed the Constitution in this great debate over whether to ratify it were very worried that it did that. Madison and the Federalist wrote, don't worry. If the federal government becomes tyrannical, we have the militias of the states, and we trust our people with those arms, and they can win the civil war that would result. So it was a very – people ask me, as you can imagine, so what was it? Was it intended to be an individual right, or was it the militias? And the answer is that I give is it was both and it was neither. It was an individual right to gun ownership to fulfill the civic duty and responsibility to serve in the militia. Our question today, the kinds of things we focus on in gun debates, would make no sense to the framers, just like their answers in some ways don't make sense to us now.
What about the Bill of Rights in general? Weren't there some people who felt that there was no need for them because the Constitution pretty much provided protections through the states' rights? You write, the Bill of Rights was born of a pander to a noisy interest group in a single congressional district.
Yes, it's an amazingly interesting story. Among the people who didn't think we needed a Bill of Rights was James Madison. Madison thought that the way you prevented government from oppressing people's rights was through the checks and balances and through balancing off the federal and the local governments and all those kinds of things.
Great if it worked.
Great if it worked. What happened was to get the Constitution ratified through the various states where it was very controversial, eventually states started saying, we'll vote for it, we'll ratify it, but we want to see some amendments. But there were dozens and dozens of amendments proposed or recommended. James Madison had helped write the Constitution. He had argued for doing it without amendments. He wrote the Federalist. Then he ran for Congress in the first congressional election. And they actually gerrymandered his district. His big political enemy, Patrick Henry, drew a district that would be very hard for him to win. And the issue, it turned out, was he had to appeal to the religious minority in the district, who were the Baptists, who were oppressed by the Presbyterians. And they said, we'll vote for you, Madison, if you come out for a religious freedom amendment, which we now know is the First Amendment. And Madison did a flip-flop, and he vowed he would pass amendments. And then he went to Congress, and he took the lead in writing amendments.
Constitution was adopted in September 1787, but not ratified until March 1789. Would it have been ratified without a promise that there would be a Bill of Rights?
Probably not. It might have been, but it would have had less legitimacy. And a number of the big states, including New York, people were very worried about it and wanted to make sure that that these rights were protected. The people who wrote the amendments, though, didn't necessarily – we sort of think of them as like the Ten Commandments and tablets. I mean, Madison originally proposed 17 amendments. They dealt with everything from the size of congressional districts and congressional pay to the things we now know of.
But also property rights and things like that.
Property rights and all other kinds of things. And it's when it comes to the Second Amendment, what were they thinking about? Americans had plenty of guns. And they expected to have a right to defend themselves, especially in their homes. That came down from England through common law. There were also lots of gun control laws and gun regulations at the time. It was, for example, illegal to keep a loaded gun in your home in Boston because it was dangerous and all other kinds of things. When you look at the actual drafting of the Second Amendment, you can look at the notes Madison took at the Constitutional Convention, at the public records of the ratification conventions all over the country, with a few scattered exceptions, and very much the debate in the Congress on the Second Amendment, where they debated what it meant. There's not a word about hunting, self-protection, or the other things we think about when it comes to the Second Amendment. It's all about the militias and this political purpose. And, of course, the militias vanished pretty soon afterwards, and we have had to grapple ever since with what this confusing language means in each new era. We cannot go back in a time machine, an originalist time machine, and expect them to give us the answer.
My guest is Michael Waldman, who is president of the Brennan Center at NYU. Excuse me. His book from Simon & Schuster, The Second Amendment, A Biography. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Does the order of the Ten Amendments of the Bill of Rights reflect the priority that the drafters attached to the rights?
Well, some people say it does.
Because the Second Amendment comes right after the guarantee of freedom of speech, religion, and assembly, which one would have thought would have been the number one priority. But then there are other really important amendments, and they follow the second.
And it comes, of course, then the Third Amendment. And again, originally the Second Amendment was the Fifth Amendment. And what we now know is the Third Amendment blocks government from quartering troops in people's homes. Some people have said, well, what this reflects is the military amendments grouped together. Others have said, and the NRA and other advocates of gun rights today would say, the fact that it is, as they argue, the amendment that makes the other amendments possible, because it is armed citizens who protect their own rights. But at the time, it was much it was much more political, much more of a the push and pull between the elected officials who wrote the Bill of Rights, who didn't necessarily think it was necessary, and an angry but somewhat unfocused public who was very worried about government, and this new government could be tyrannical, and raised a ruckus, but wasn't so focused on the details. We, of course, now look at this as if every comma, every clause was etched in stone. And, and of course, the Bill of Rights has taken on a much greater meaning in the last 100 years than it ever had before that.
Is it ironic that when we hear people talk about protecting themselves against the federal government or the UN, we consider them the lunatic fringe when, in fact, they are closest to the original intent of the Second Amendment?
It's ironic, although even there are ironies, because you have somebody like Cliven Bundy, who was the rancher out in Nevada, who said, I'm fulfilling the framers and what they meant, and I'm going to decide what laws I'm going to follow, and I'm armed. And he stood down against the federal government earlier this year.
Luckily, he wasn't in Ferguson, Missouri.
Luckily, he was not in Ferguson, Missouri. And one can imagine if that, if people were brandishing arms openly there. But of course, at the time of the Constitution, they had just had Shays' Rebellion, where the local Cliven Bundys of their day said, "Well, we just had this revolution. We know this means we have a right to revolt, and we're gonna take arms and not follow the courts in Western Massachusetts," and the government crushed it. And that was actually one of the reasons they had the Constitutional Convention. So they were really thinking more about the organized, governmentally sanctioned militias of the 13 states.
Weren't they acting on the guarantees of the British Bill of Rights from 1689? William Blackstone, the English jurist, described the English rights as a public allowance under due restrictions of the natural right of resistance and self-preservation when the sanctions of society and laws are found insufficient to restrain the violence of oppression. That would have been, by the way, it seems to me, a justification for the American Revolution, and yet the British fought it despite the fact that they had that Bill of Rights.
Blackstone was a legal writer and judge in England, was very influential among the colonists and then among the early Americans. And the English Bill of Rights, which came out of the Glorious Revolution 100 years before, gave gun rights, but they were limited to Protestants and they were limited ultimately to the upper class in England. So it was a somewhat different notion of what gun rights were. And as I say, that people felt that people were assumed to have the right to protect themselves in their homes especially. And it went along with gun laws that you couldn't carry around menacing weapons, you couldn't store guns. There were all kinds of gun registrations. So from the beginning, and at least it seems the framers probably didn't think they were putting all that in the Constitution when they wrote this amendment, in their minds, on the militia. As the country grew and moved west, we became more individualistic. And people's ideas of gun rights became more of an individual right. You had the Wild West, and you had, the role of guns changed in American life, though even there, too, you had kind of gun rights and gun responsibilities all along, even to the point where in the Dodge City, the archetypal Western frontier six-shooter town, there's a wonderful photograph from 1879 of Main Street in Dodge City. And it looks like a movie set. And there's a dusty Main Street and the saloons, and it says, "Welcome to Dodge City, firearms strictly prohibited." There's always been gun restrictions and responsibility as well as gun rights. And we just kind of we rearrange what that balance is in each new era.
Did British law continue to be the American law until the ratification of the Constitution, the Bill of Rights?
You had, starting in 1776, mostly, revolutionary governments took over the colonies, pushed out the governments there, and actually wrote constitutions and new laws for those states. They were independent states until the Constitution wove them together.
Weren't the people involved in Shays' Rebellion quite poor?
They were.
They
poor.
Would not have been allowed to own guns in England.
They would not have been allowed to own guns, and a lot of them didn't own property, so they wouldn't have been allowed to vote in the United States either. At the beginning. So, although interestingly, the militia was everybody. and in Pennsylvania, where you had people like Ben Franklin saying, well, if everybody's in the militia, everybody should be able to vote.
Did the divisions over fears about a centralized government reflect more than political differences among the colonists, economic differences or so, differences of privilege perhaps?
These have been, of course, some of the great themes of how of history and of how we understand the American Revolution from the beginning. The progressive era historians, for example, would say that that the purpose of the Constitution was for the creditors who were worried about people not wanting to pay their debts to sort of stabilize the credit system and so they could retain their power and privilege. Others said, this was nationalists. It was the young men who'd actually served in the army saying, we're going to have a failed state here, what we would call a failed state, if we don't thrust much more emphatically toward a central government and to do it the way a real country would. But even these gun debates, such as they were, played out with some of those same arguments. In Pennsylvania, the very first state to ratify the Constitution, the Federalists, the people who supported the Constitution, they tended to be the people in Philadelphia, the big city. They were the elite. They were Quakers. And the people who were worried about the Constitution were from Western Pennsylvania. They were backwoodsmen. And
nothing's changed.
And one of the things that was urged there, although they never even got to introduce it in the convention there, was not only that you should have the right to have a gun for militia service, but for hunting and other things too. And that was sort of kept out of the debate. But I note in the book that Barack Obama was not the first urban politician to note that Western Pennsylvanians cling to their guns and religion. These rural and urban divides go back a long way.
Although he got in a lot of trouble for saying it.
He did.
Michael Waldman is president of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law, nonpartisan law and policy institute that focuses on improving the systems of democracy and justice. His book, The Second Amendment, A Biography, is published by Simon & Schuster, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we are back with Michael Waldman, president of the Brennan Center at NYU. His book, The Second Amendment, a biography, is published by Simon & Schuster. Some of the people involved in the debate over the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, almost sound like the Tea Party members of 1787, especially George Mason and Patrick Henry. Would they be considered conservatives in today's sense?
It's very hard to drop those historical figures onto a left-right continuum the way we might want to, the way our minds might assume ought to be the case.
Well, how were they seen in their own time?
In their time, they were seen as patriots for Virginia. They were, in the case of George Mason, concerned with individual liberties to a certain degree. But very worried, very fearful, above all else, about a central government, what they regarded as potential tyranny in the making. And they'd all had the experience, of course, with King George. They also were worried, for example, in a place like Virginia, about slavery, that a strong central government, as far-fetched as it may have been, would somehow come in and upend their special institution. And in fact, it's this view of government and what people's attitude is toward central government tends to be what drives a lot of the way people look at gun rights. So after the Civil War, the 14th Amendment, one of the purposes of it was to make sure, in fact, that the former African-American slaves could get access to guns on the same basis as white people. Once the 20th century came and you started having people move into cities in New York and other places, people realized in those cases that they needed a stronger government and they were much more comfortable with strong gun laws. It really had more to do with kind of a libertarian versus communal sense than anything else.
Of the 10 Bill of Rights, were some debated more than others? Where does the Second Amendment stand?
Yes. I would say the First Amendment was really what was driving the whole thing. It really was about religious the thing that people were focused on in talking about the amendments was especially the Bill of Rights and its concerns. Although it is the case, and the historian Bernard Bailyn and others say that the fear of centralized military power was one of the main themes underlying people's opposition to the Constitution.
Well, in the middle of the 20th century, or even in the early part of the 20th century, I think the 10th Amendment was the one that came up most in political debate. Now we don't hear much about it. Now it's the First and Second Amendments. How has that shifted?
In some ways, it goes back to this shift in the thought of James Madison, who at first thought that it was the checks and balances of government and different layers of government and different wings of government would protect people's rights. And as the country became more individualistic and our understanding of how we want to organize ourselves in a sense became more individualistic, you started to have the Bill of Rights treated as a more meaningful guarantee of individual liberties for people. You know, as I'm sure you know, the Bill of Rights was only applied to the states starting really in the 1920s in the United States and effectively really in the 1960s and 70s, so that things like the right of free speech, the right to a speedy trial, all those things only became meaningful over the past 75 years, not before that. But the last one of those Bill of Rights to be treated that way was the Second Amendment.
And you would have thought that these rights would have covered certain things, but we still needed a Civil Rights Act. We needed a number of other acts that laid it out more explicitly.
Well, that's right. I mean, the parchment barriers, as Madison originally derisively called something like a Bill of Rights, has only been the start. It's always been social movements and political activism that define how we actually see these things. And that was true for guns and gun rights. And the NRA actually waged a very effective campaign over many decades to get us to this point.
The NRA started off as a very different kind of organization, didn't it?
It did indeed. It's been around quite a while. It was started by former Union officers who were worried after the Civil War about poor marksmanship by the troops. And it focused on training and marksmanship and military preparedness to a certain degree. Eventually, it spoke for hunters and sportsmen. It was not very exercised about gun safety and gun control laws. In fact, it testified for federal gun laws in the 1930s and supported them in the 1960s.
The National Firearms Act of 1934.
Right, and it was not opposed to the Gun Control Act of 1968. What happened with the NRA was a big change. You know, we all know that the social movements of the 60s were quite important, but the backlash against the 1960s was pretty important, too, and the NRA was part of that. In 1977, in what's still known as the Revolt at Cincinnati among people involved, the NRA had made clear they were going to be withdrawing further from politics and actually moving their headquarters to Colorado from Washington, D.C. And at their annual meeting, 1,000 activists showed up, voted out the old leadership, voted in new leadership that was much more doctrinaire, much more dogmatic, and that refashioned the organization as a constitutional crusade around the idea that the Second Amendment gave you or recognized an individual right. And in fact, when you go to the NRA headquarters now in Fairfax, Virginia, you walk into the lobby, and they used to have big signs about training and safety. Now they've got the Second Amendment in pride of place, but it's important to look at it closely. It's edited. They actually edited out the first half about the well-regulated militia. They have two dots. They don't even have three dots. And they waged a 30-year campaign. They started with scholarship. They moved public opinion so that it really is now the kind of common sense view. And only eventually did they go to court.
Now, did they want it applied across the board? For example, would the NRA be in support of Black Panthers having guns? Because that was a big issue in Oakland and other parts of the country.
So in the 60s, this issue arose in some respects in part when the Black Panthers went to the state capitol in Sacramento with guns saying, hey, it's our right. And the politicization of the NRA, the right turn, really came after later.
During the Reagan years or
it
before?
Came in the 70s kind of grew to full force in the Reagan years. And, you know, we don't think of the NRA anymore as speaking for hunters particularly as much as a kind of an insurrectionist opposition to the strong central government and a very ardent libertarian view of what people's rights are, that any restriction on gun ownership of any kind tramples on the sacred will of the founders. And that's something of a new view.
Wasn't Ronald Reagan a member of the NRA? Did he remain a member after John Hinckley shot him?
Reagan remained a member of the NRA, and of course his press secretary, James Brady, who just died recently, became a very courageous advocate for the Brady Bill, as it was known, which had background checks and a waiting period. It became very political. So it used to be the NRA was more bipartisan, and it was really more rural. And now it's very much a part of the Republican and conservative coalition, and you have the five justices who voted for this 2008 decision where the Supreme Court for the first time recognized an individual gun right. All those five justices were appointed by presidents who were themselves members of the NRA. Although George H.W. Bush resigned in protest from the NRA over their violent rhetoric.
Was George W. Bush a member?
Yes.
But not Barack Obama, Bill Clinton.
That's right.
You worked for Bill Clinton.
I was Bill Clinton's chief speechwriter for 4 years and worked for him for 7 years. And he'd been doing battle with the NRA and really thinking about these gun issues since he was in Arkansas and was very focused on trying to win over the kind of the hunters, the sensible hunters, and with mixed success.
Joel from Westchester asks, wasn't there a 1939 court decision that said that the first phrase in the Second Amendment was the First Amendment? More recently, haven't open carry advocates interpreted the Second Amendment as a free speech issue?
Well, the 1939 decision was called Miller, in which the Supreme Court upheld the federal gun law, and it was quite clear that looking at the history and how the Second Amendment had played out, that the only kinds of guns that could be banned, that could not be banned, were ones that interfered with militia service. That the Supreme Court in 1939 unanimously ruled that the purpose of the Second Amendment was to enable states to maintain these militias. Obviously, the Supreme Court now has effectively overturned that, although it kind of doesn't really fess up that that's what it did. In terms of open carry, the movement especially is prominent in a place like Texas, where people carry these kind of assault weapons around, saying that this is to show they have the right to do it. And in a lot of it's actually backfired quite a bit.
Forgive the pun.
Even the NRA in its website said that it was weird and counterproductive, although they retracted that. There is in the minds of a lot of gun rights supporters a real close connection at this point between their personal liberty to speak and their armed ability to protect it, I think in some parts of the country that seems self-evidently right, in other parts of the country, maybe more crowded urban areas that seem self-evidently misguided.
I was wondering about the colonial period or after the revolution where flintlocks were the norm. Did people do armed robberies with flintlocks? Were there armed robberies at the time?
In those days, it was such a different world, and that's why I go back to saying I don't think we can really draw our lessons in terms of originalism quite so literally from the founding era. There weren't so many armed robberies. It took a long time to load up your musket. People actually used knives more often.
Because they could just say, hold it while I get this thing going. Okay.
Well, plus they didn't. You could aim, and you'd be very lucky if you hit the other person. Before the Civil War, the reason that the Union officers founded the NRA because of poor marksmanship is that it never even made sense to train soldiers in marksmanship before the Civil War because the guns were so inaccurate that it wasn't worth spending the time.
Now, precedent allows gun control, but recently the court has moved in the other direction. Are they just ignoring precedent?
So you had this big case in 2008.
And you have to give me a quick answer, unfortunately.
Yeah. So the court struck down quite a bit of precedent. But now lower courts have had to interpret, because the Supreme Court said, yes, there's an individual right, but also there can be restrictions. That's what Justice Scalia wrote. And so the question is, what is the nature of the right and what kinds of restrictions? Overwhelmingly, dozens of cases have been brought. 96% of them, courts have upheld existing gun laws. Even under this Supreme Court, conservative Supreme Court, there's been some, lately, some cases where gun laws have been struck down. But, you know, mostly the courts have said, yes, there's an individual right, but society has a right to protect itself, too.
Michael Waldman's book is The Second Amendment, a biography. He is president of the Brennan Center at NYU. The book is published by Simon & Schuster. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.